The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. On this America's Labor Day, John Hockenberry and I are considering what is the hardest work we have to do in the USA right now to meet the greatest challenges facing our country and our world.
It's likely your idea might be on the global action plan that world leaders are being asked to commit to this year. It's also quite likely that your ideas could be significantly more ambitious. Later this month, 193 world leaders will gather here in New York at the United Nations to decide on the most ambitious universal global development agenda to date. It's a plan that will shape the policies of governments around the world for the next 15 years. The 17 so-called Sustainable Development Goals in the agenda call for an end to extreme poverty everywhere, to fight inequality and injustice, and to fix climate change.
We'll consider this hour what might truly be accomplished when our leaders are motivated by the same mission. We'll hear from you, too, about what challenges you think need urgent attention. But we start with a look at how these goals get narrowed down and chosen. How do we measure success? According to David Miliband, president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee and former UK Foreign Secretary, we can take the good and the bad from an earlier attempt to set targets for the planet. He says the Millennium Development Goals provide some valuable lessons.
All of my experience in government, in NGOs, but also my learning from the private sector, is that without proper accountability and proper specifics, then goals are just talk, they're not real action. And it's interesting that the lesson of the last 15 years of the so-called Millennium Development Goals that were launched in 2000 at the turn of the century, the lesson of those is that the more specific the targets, for example, in respect of maternal mortality, or for example, in the respect of progress towards the eradication of malaria, the more specific the targets, the more accountable have been the government bodies and the UN agencies for delivery, and the more progress has been made. And I think it's very, very important that as the nations of the world, which make up the United Nations, come together in September, they talk very seriously about implementation of the next steps of the drive to eradicate global poverty, never mind to take on board the sustainable, quote-unquote sustainable element in the Sustainable Development Goals, which is to take account of factors like climate change that are a living reality in the kind of countries where the International Rescue Committee works, in the Sahel, in Africa, across large parts of the Middle East. Climate change is a reality, and to talk about tackling poverty without addressing climate change just doesn't make sense.
Now, one of the global interventions from here in the United States that does get credit for having worked is called PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, started during the Bush administration, continued now. That's a massive American undertaking in underdeveloped countries in Africa and Asia hit by the AIDS crisis that is credited with having made a huge difference. And I take it from what you're saying that the goals and the interventions in that American AIDS relief program were very specific, targetable, and in many cases, we've hit them.
Well, the short answer to that is yes, that PEPFAR is a very good example of a development program that's worked. It's really important to understand that over the last 15 years, the biggest strides in reducing poverty have been in countries like China and India, who through economic growth have pulled literally hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. But we've also got experience through programs like PEPFAR to show that when accountability is established, when clear targets are set, and when significant resource is put behind drives like this, then the world can mobilize and can make a real difference, harnessing the power of science, but also the power of local populations to change behavior as well as to offer medicines in a way that really does make a difference. The big drive behind the next 15 years is going to have to be to take the campaigns for health and for education into some of the toughest areas in the world, because the truth is an increasing proportion of the world's poor are trapped in conflict states, trapped in countries like Syria, like Somalia, like Afghanistan, where conflict is a 20 or 30 year reality and where it makes it that much harder to deliver education services, health services, never mind to get a decent economy going.
I found something missing, if I can say so, from the goals as I was looking through them, the lofty goals that we've discussed, these golden goals. Good health, no hunger, no poverty, climate action we've talked about, of course, reduced inequality. Mr. Secretary, one goal that isn't in here, that's an important one and a tough one, is less corruption. less corruption in many of the governments that you and your colleagues at the UN will be dealing with to realize these goals. And it seems like political corruption, financial corruption is a major obstacle to the type of economic development that you're talking about.
It's a vital point that corruption stands in the way of not just decency in countries, not just economic growth, but also stands in the way of tackling poverty. I think it's important to emphasize that our experience at the International Rescue Committee, where we have helped last year about 17 million people in conflict zones around the world, is that when you work at community level, you can battle against the corruption that seems to mark some of the big projects, the big infrastructure projects that have often typified the attempt to establish a quick fix in different countries. And our learning in countries like Afghanistan is that when you work at local level, sometimes having to work around local state structures, you can establish the community confidence that money is being used for their benefit. And that's certainly a very important element of the transparency that's going to be vital if we're going to make progress. There's one other thing I think it's important to say that's missing in the way these goals have been framed. I think many people listening would be shocked to know that while 15 years ago about 10% of the world's extreme poor lived in conflict states, today that figure is 43% and it's on its way up to two-thirds. And our view from working in conflict states around the world is that the geography of poverty, the pattern of poverty around the world, is increasingly focused on those 30 to 40 countries where government doesn't work, where conflict is pervasive, sometimes where there are battles over resources, other cases where there's battles over religion or over ethnicity. And it's going to be vital over the next 5, 10, 15 years to ensure that in pursuing these lofty goals, we establish very clear floor targets to make sure that people in conflict zones are not left behind. So when we say we want to get 75% of kids into primary and secondary education and ultimately 100%, we must make sure that it's not the kids in the conflict states that get left behind. And the evidence at the moment in a country like Lebanon, where there's over 1 million Syrian refugees, there's over 300,000 kids not in education. And these are the basics of tackling poverty and ensuring that it's not transmitted to the next generation. And so I hope that there's a debate this September in New York, not just about the goals, but about their implementation. Because if we don't take that seriously, then we're not going to do justice to the ambitions that have been set out.
You have plenty of experience in these conflict zones and with refugees, of course, also plenty of experience in government in Europe. We're in the midst of a situation right now with refugees pouring in from the Syrian conflict into Europe through Hungary, through Austria, into Germany, and all of the conflict and dysfunction right now that we're seeing between European states. Is there some level of discouragement for goals like this, for international cooperation on problems of refugees, conflict, climate change, and the rest of it, when you see a Europe which has to help and take the lead in these issues, which can't agree on its borders or what to do with refugees right now?
Well, Europe has historically been a leader of the humanitarian system. It's been a leader of the drive for universal rights to be established. And there's no question that Europe is now in moral as well as political and policy crisis in the face of the tsunami of bad news, the terrible 4-5 year conflict in Syria, the ongoing conflict in Somalia and Congo that is producing a wave of refugees, the like of which the world has never seen before. Just for the benefit of your listeners, last year was a terrible world record, 20 million refugees around the world, 40 million people displaced within their own country. And the response of the international community, both in peacemaking in countries like Syria, but also in treating the symptoms of conflict, namely the refugee flow that results, has been very weak indeed. And Europe has been consumed by the crisis in Ukraine, by the euro crisis in Greece over the last 2 or 3 years, and frankly hasn't had its eye on the ball of this refugee crisis. That means that a country like Germany wakes up today and says, we're going to have 800,000 asylum seekers in our country this year. And this is certainly a European crisis that demands a European response. But frankly, it also demands an international response, including the United States, because historically the US has taken a very large number, about 50% of the world's resettled refugees. But since the Syria conflict started, only 1,434, to be absolutely precise, have arrived in the US. And so there has been inertia where there needs to be leadership. And that's really a fundamental challenge, yes, to the European countries that have got this stock of people now inside Europe who they need to share out, but also globally to tackle the roots of the problem and to deal with its symptoms.
So the U.S. government and the U.S. State Department has come under some criticism, and in your view, justified criticism for not taking a more active role with the crippling refugee crisis from the Syrian conflict. At the same time, Mr. Secretary, we are in the midst of a political season in this country where a big part of the conversation, frankly, is about the opposite. A major part of the debate right now, at least in the Republican primary, is about building a wall, building a fence between the United States and Mexico. Sure, on a practical level, it may never happen, but the symbolism of such a wall and such a fence and such an attitude, I would take it as a bit troubling to you.
Well, I obviously am a relative newcomer to the United States, as you can tell from my accent. I observe U.S. politics as an observer rather than as a participant. But I can bring to bear some experience from elsewhere. Look, the debate about walls in Europe has shown that the bigger the walls, the more ingenious or the more criminal are the attempts to get round them. The absence of legal routes into Europe for those fleeing for their lives means that there's real empowerment of criminal gangs who are the last hope for people who are being barrel-bombed in their homes in Syria and don't have legal routes to claim refugee status. And it's obviously not for me as the leader of an NGO to become involved in partisan politics, still less intra-party politics within the Democratic or Republican parties. But what I think is clear is that this country has historically been a leader in refugee resettlement and has been a leading light for the benefits of a diverse society. E pluribus unum, after all, has been the defining element of this country and has brought people from all around the world and actually brought people to New York, to this city, as the ultimate global city. And the success of this company factors, but one of them has been its ability to harness talent from all around the world. And I think that the management of refugee flows is a feature of the modern world, where the attempt to believe that it can that there can be crisis in the Middle East or crisis across Africa and not affect the rest of us just is belied by reality. And I hope that the positive examples of managed migration and managed refugee flows in the United States is something that Europeans will learn from in a positive way.
Nations in conflict and managing a broad refugee crisis are just some of the elements adding to the complexities facing the world as leaders prepare to adopt the next set of sustainable development goals. David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee and former foreign secretary for the United Kingdom.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
193 nations agreeing on 17 global goals is an extraordinary accomplishment in and of itself. But how do you unify 7 billion people around one common task? For that, John has been speaking to John MacArthur. From 2002 to 2006, he served as manager and then deputy director for the UN Millennium Project, where he worked specifically on developing an action plan for achieving the Millennium Development Goals, the predecessor of the new global goals.
The starting point has to be recognizing the complexity of the world. We're at 7.3 billion people, en route pretty soon to 8 billion. There's no single organizing method for all of this. That's cutting across first the, say, technical discipline. So, again, global health. There's a whole series of constituencies who are deep in the day-to-day trenches of figuring out how to take on the next issue of, say, neonatal mortality, how to get the malaria vaccine going, how to build the health systems in the poorest parts of the world so that when the Ebola strikes next time or whatever the horrendous next equivalent might be, it's nipped in the bud from day one through a strong local health system. And similarly, the agronomists focused on how to tackle hunger, or the nutritionists focused on how to make sure the quality of the food is good. You know, these are particular what are often called epistemic communities of people who are focused on thinking on the practicalities within their domain. But there's another piece, which is it's not a single global conversation for any of these issues because there are so many differences in different parts of the world. And we see that there needs to be, in my view, some form of regional cooperation, whether that's in Southeast Asia to take on issues like flood risk or environmental management, or in West Africa to take on issues of drought and climate adaptation, agricultural resilience. Each of these issues needs both the local within countries and even down to the community level, and the cross-country coordination, and I would say the global stock-taking to say, you know, how do we understand how the world's doing as a world?
Is it going to be possible between now and 2030 for people to actually log in or find a place to go to see how well we're doing on any of these issues, and for politicians and stakeholders in individual countries to hold people to account as to whether they're close to their goals or not? Or does all this stay in a bunch of papers that nobody ever reads in the closets of the United Nations?
This starting point answer is that there are the global websites that anyone can log on to say, how's my country doing on child mortality? How's that doing compared to other countries? You know, is the rate of progress fast enough to get to these goals? You can do that, and you can check every year. I actually don't think that's good enough, because the world is a little more complicated than that, and the world is more sophisticated than that. And there are a bunch of areas where the data aren't good enough yet. But there's a whole movement underway for what people are calling a data revolution, where you can have community-generated data that is, you know, both real and in the world of big data and even all these forms of big corporate sources of data around, you know, understanding real patterns of behavior, real financial transactions, real movements of people. There's got to be better ways to understand in real time how our societies are doing around the world. I have a friend in West Africa who's just launched with a bunch of West African entrepreneurs a whole effort to generate local data to inform local efforts in real time for these sustainable development goals. And this is where we're just starting to get a taste of how a new world can organize with better information. I'm of the view that this is one of the areas of great hope for humanity, where a lot of ingenuity will give us, just like cell phones, none of us would have guessed 15 years ago how big this is going to be, incredibly improved approaches to public feedback on public issues.
There's a general critique here that I'm sure you're familiar with. Folks like Dambisi Moyo say the whole track record of development is pretty paltry in the end, and that it employs a lot of people at think tanks such as yourself, but it doesn't end up really having the kind of impact on the ground that the visionaries expect. And, you know, there is certainly an argument to be made in places like Zaire and South Sudan that, you know, maybe you folks in the West just sitting back and watching might be better than all of the intervention you've done over the last 300 years. Let's try that for once and see if we can't help ourselves here a little bit, especially if you would share some of the resources in the world. What do you say to that argument and that level of cynicism about Western cooperation with the rest of the world?
I think there's a lot of truth to complaining about diktats from above in any part of the world. And I think that there's a lot of merit to saying, you know, this is not a good way to organize a global community. I think if we think through the second piece, though, of what's actually happening, well, I would argue we're in the middle of probably the fastest rate of progress in human history on a lot of these issues. Is it enough? No. Do we need to see more? Yes. And again, I've just spent in the past couple of weeks a lot of time with some colleagues from around Africa. One of the things that's so interesting is they say that when they look at this agenda, they're so happy that this is something that they have had a clear say in, and they feel that they own this sustainable development goal discussion as much as anyone. And it's not talking at them. It's them helping to write their own story in cooperation with the world. And many people haven't felt like that before, and I think that's quite exciting.
Well, John MacArthur, certainly a worthy set of labors to contemplate on this Labor Day. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
John MacArthur is a senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institution.
And still to come this hour, a conversation about climate. John Hockenberry picks up that theme with several faith leaders who think we should all pay attention to the Pope's earlier encyclical on climate change. Also, a look at the role big data plays in feeding our growing population, and the science of keeping populations healthy when there's a lack of clean drinking water. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Curious.com, featuring personalized learning plans that help each member of the household achieve their learning goals, from anthropology to anti-aliasing to Arduino. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
This year, Pope Francis became one of the world's most influential leaders on climate change issues. It was something of a surprise. And later this month, when Pope Francis makes his first papal visit to the United States, he'll be bringing that message to the UN General Assembly that's celebrating its 70th anniversary on September 15th. On the UN's agenda is a new set of ambitious so-called sustainable development goals, and one of these goals is to combat climate change. Back in June, Pope Francis shared his encyclical on the environment with the world. Laudato Si, or Praised Be, is a call for urgent action to preserve and protect our planet, or as Francis called it, our common home. The Pope wasn't only addressing the world's Roman Catholics with his teaching. His encyclical was designed to inspire everyone, and especially the world's richest nations, to do more to tackle environmental challenges. We wanted to find out how the Pope's message was motivating different faith communities to protect the planet. Rabbi Lawrence Troster is founder and coordinator of Shamre Breshet, Rabbis and Cantors for the Earth. And Rabbi Steve Gatto is president of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs and chair of the National Religious Partnership for the Environment. Rabbi Troster says this global togetherness is actually perfectly natural and gives him a lot of enthusiasm.
The Pope very specifically addresses the encyclical to everybody in the world, which is unique, because he really wants to start a worldwide conversation of people of all faith and scientists and economists and business people. So this is something different.
And would you say it's an opportunity to express the power of all of these religions together, something we haven't seen a lot of so far this century?
I think the world's scared to death. Those of us that know the science and understand faith, for a breakthrough in saying that this is going to change our lives if we don't deal with it. And when the Pope, who is a pretty powerful man, comes out and says, we've got to stop it, we'd be stupid not to look at our own faiths and try to bring them all together in a fairly spiritual and scientific and moral way.
What are the advantages you see of addressing the environment through a religious dimension, and what are the limitations, do you think?
Well, we don't pretend to be scientists, but we listen to scientists, we talk to scientists, we learn from scientists. So we can't come from that stance. But what we can do in the religious environmental movement, what we have been doing for decades, is come from a moral perspective. What are the moral implications of what is going on? And that, I think, is where the religious community has been particularly effective in saying, what is the disparity between the use of resources and those people who are suffering from the degradation resulting from that resources? That's where the religious community, I think, has been very effective.
Since the little blue ball picture of the Earth was broadcast around the world after Apollo 11, people have had a sense of brotherhood of man, we're living on a fragile planet, you know, that sort of thing. But it seems that this issue makes the planetary domain more specific in some way in this century. You could kind of see it in the picture, but there's something about climate change that really creates a sort of borderless Earth that I think the church is dealing with for the first time here. How does coming together as faiths make this point in this century for the very first time?
I think the answer is faiths rarely do come together. And the fact is that so many of us are using the words of the Pope not just to say, this is what the Catholics are doing, but as to say, this is what we have to do.
Are you on the Vatican's team on this one, or is the Vatican on your team, Larry?
I think one of the things that is different in this century is the sense of interconnection through electronic media has grown so intense and also so intimate. We are more aware of things that are going on the other side of the world so quickly that I think this has helped to create a sense of moral interconnectedness. And that's, I think, is what's different now.
Rabbi Steve Gateau is president of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs and chair of the National Religious Partnership for the Environment. And Rabbi Lawrence Troster is founder and coordinator of Shamrei Breshet, Rabbis and Cantors for the Earth. Ramadan, the Muslim holy month of prayer and fasting, this year took place in the hot summer months in the Northern Hemisphere. For California Imam Mustafa Umar, the Pope's message on global warming was an unusual opportunity for Muslims, including the members of his mosque, to think about their responsibility for Earth and its resources. Imam Umar is education and outreach director at the Islamic Institute of Orange County in Anaheim, California.
When it came out, we said Alhamdulillah, which means praise be to God. We said, you know, this, it's about time that we have a large organization, international organization like the church, speaking out on something like this. There's a term in the Quran that's used. It's called the word Khalifa, which is not used in a political sense as head of state, but in the linguistic sense, it means somebody who's a deputy acting on behalf of somebody else. So human beings are described in the Quran as being a Khalifa acting on behalf, a deputy acting on behalf of God. So while we're here, we have this privilege, and this privilege comes with a responsibility. And that responsibility is you can use the things that God has created, but you can't abuse them. And that's part of our test in life. So there's a lot of doctrines that you find in the Quran, and you find in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, where he talks about, you know, if you're using water, even if you're at the bank of a river, don't waste that water, right? Because somebody else could have utilized it after you. So the emphasis on responsibility and not wasting things, not destroying things, not corrupting things, causing corruption in the land and in the seas and all of these things, they're themes that are common throughout the Quran and throughout the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad.
Imam Mustafa, if you've observed the reaction among some Christian politicians, conservative Christian politicians, to what the Pope has said, that he should mind his own business and leave science to the scientists. How have people responded in your community, in the Muslim community generally, to the idea of Islam and environmental consciousness?
We kind of laugh off some of those more extreme comments because it's the science that's actually pointing to the fact that the environment is in danger. So when they're trying to dismiss something like this, it's pretty clear to see that they're driven more by prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, rather than the followings and the teachings of the prophets. So it's something that, you know, it's of concern that people are dismissing this, especially people who we expect that their moral framework and their, you know, moral background would support an encyclical like this, and actually they should be jumping on board and they should be happy about something like this, but instead they seem to be upset. But when it comes down to it, it depends on what you do shows what you really believe in the depth of your heart. And I think that's coming out in the open now. It's becoming more transparent.
The relationship between the people of God and the people of science has often been a divisive one, and that down through history, science has been used as a way to divide all faiths. Do you think there's a chance that this issue, that climate change and the environment, could be a moment for reversing that, for in fact coming together in a way that hasn't really been seen among all the faiths since, 1,000 years ago?
Well, first of all, I would say that may have been the case in, you know, medieval Europe among Christendom. But in Islamic history, there's never been this divide between the scientists and the Muslim scholars or the religion. You know, they've always been in quite good harmony. If you look throughout the golden age of Islam in Baghdad and in Spain and all these different regions. But in terms of now, yes, this is a great opportunity, I think, that they can unite on something in the sense that, well, see, science is just going to simply point to the problem and show, like, this is a major issue, this is a problem. Science, from the religious perspective, from the Islamic perspective, is not going to be making moral judgments. And from an Islamic perspective, we're going to step in and say, no, you know what? Yeah, there are blessings in life. God has created certain things for us, but we're not supposed to abuse them to the extent where they could be gone. We may not have anything for the next generation to even have left. They're not going to have any of these blessings. And we can, we can find alternative ways to benefit from the resources that we've been provided without destroying them for the future generations.
Imam Mustafa Umar, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Since we last spoke with Imam Umar, Islamic leaders from around the world have unveiled their own new declaration on climate change. Amongst many things, it calls on world leaders to phase out the use of fossil fuels.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So what innovations will it take for the world to sustainably grow and feed 9 billion people? One innovation is data, access to global open data for agriculture and nutrition. GoDan, it's called, and it's helping countries to see the bigger picture in the challenge to feed the world. Catherine Wotecki is Chief Scientist and Undersecretary for Research, Education, and Economics at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She explains how harvesting data can increase the harvesting of food for a hungry world.
A great example is related to genetic information about crops. One of the things that we at USDA do is to maintain a collection of germplasm from crops and their wild relatives that we have been investigating for many years and keeping over the years as a resource for plant breeders. As scientists have been sequencing the DNA of these various samples that are part of our collection, they've also been looking for the genes that convey some very valuable traits like pest or disease resistance or some quality attribute that would make this particular strain of wheat, for example, better for making bread or pastry, and identifying those specific genes and the quality traits that they convey.
The big question that you've been grappling with is how is the current state of agriculture going to feed 9 billion people? Because that's the projection, really, for, you know, the next, you know, sort of generational horizon that we have to really be conscious of in this century. Can we fill 9 billion bowls? Can we feed 9 billion people? How short are we? Or do we have any slack at this point?
We have a finite amount of farmable land. Some of that already is severely degraded. The UN estimates that about a quarter of arable land is currently severely degraded. We have, as you are very much aware, limits on water availability for agriculture. Farmers all around the world are having to deal with more variable weather conditions that are related to climate change. But in the scientific community, we think that we will be able to sustainably intensify the productivity of agriculture to be able to feed that population that's projected at mid-century at over 9 billion people, and also to be able to deliver all of the other benefits that are expected from agriculture, and that includes clean water, the production of feedstocks that are going to be used for biofuels and other industrial chemicals, and to do that in a way that's going to be sustainable into the future generations beyond the year 2050.
Let me give you a contrary notion here, a very negative one, in fact. And that is that, you know, whenever I hear big data and sustainable development and global this and global that, I'm recalling my times in the Middle East and in sub-Saharan Africa and in the Horn of Africa, where there were huge resources brought to bear on all kinds of problems, particularly with famine in the Horn of Africa and instability in Somalia and others I could name, Zaire, etc. But everything came down to the last mile. Everything. The last mile determined whether there was a truck to get it to the people. the last mile determined whether there was a militia that was going to steal everything that was coming from the United Nations, whether it was Unimix or milk or medicine. The last mile was going to determine if there was even a road that could get to the people that needed it most. And if that last mile didn't function, all of the work that had been done up to that point was completely wasted. Is that still true? Is that really a problem now? And are you even thinking about that at this conference?
None of these solutions are going to be applicable in every setting under every circumstance. And then particularly as we're working with increasing agricultural productivity and doing that in a sustainable way, we're going to be needing also to focus on what is the local condition and what is the local infrastructure, particularly if we want to be reducing losses and waste in the food system to increase the amount of food that's available to the population. So the kind of crops, the infrastructure, the roads, the kinds of storage systems that are available, all of that local circumstance is going to be enormously important to go that final mile.
Farmers and food producers are known for having fleets of just spectacular machines, combines, planters, you know, even more exotic things that I can't even name. Is that going to include fleets of drones to monitor food production?
Well, it already does. I think there are, and I'm certainly very much aware of farmers that have been using unmanned vehicles to assess the state of their crops. So what condition the crop is in. And agriculture is actually being looked at as one of the major markets for drones.
Well, Catherine Wotecki, Chief Scientist and Undersecretary for Research, Education, and Economics at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
End this hour on a more humble goal relating to health and how difficult it is to know if an agreed-upon plan is working. 1 billion kids with lack of access to clean water in this world are at risk of developing a worm infection. Worm infections weaken kids and contribute to malnutrition, anemia, stunted growth, and early death. In 2004, a study published by Edward Miguel, a professor of environmental and resource economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and Michael Kremer at Harvard, found a simple deworming pill helped kids in Kenya improve their overall health and their performance in school. After an endorsement by the World Health Organization, NGOs and governments started giving pills to hundreds of millions of kids every year, whether they were infected or not. 2 years ago, Miguel and Kremer released some very positive data from their fieldwork in Kenya and ran into some criticism. Two independent studies published last month found a substantial amount of missing data, and that while worm infections decreased, some claimed benefits didn't happen. Today, Professor Edward Miguel answers his critics. The deworming pill, he says, is not perfect, but it could be the best tool out there if used properly.
Yeah, so it's not like a vaccine. The recommended approach to deworming is to do it periodically. So typically in areas where there's high levels of infection, once or twice a year, it's recommended that that individuals be treated. And that basically clears the worms out of people's intestines, you know, kills them off, expels the worms. But what ends up happening is in these environments where there's a lot of infected fecal matter, people get reinfected. And that's why you need to just continue the treatment every 6 months or year. So unfortunately, there isn't a vaccine. And in many ways, it would be easier if it was just a one-shot vaccine like you get for measles or something. But it's more complicated than that.
What is the scale of these infections? How many people are affected? And what are the impacts on diet, overall health, and longevity?
So there's hundreds of millions of kids. And, you know, globally, if you count adults and kids, over a billion people have these parasitic infections. So they're extremely widespread. In a region of Kenya where I've been working for a long time, we started studying worms in the late 1990s, and we did a survey of school children. And over 90% of them had these infections. So it was really like pretty much everybody had them in some of these areas. What ends up happening with the worms is they get into your intestines. They lead to internal bleeding. They reduce your absorption of nutrients. They affect your nutrition. And they can lead to weakness, lethargy, and so have a range of consequences for people's lives. When children are treated and the worms are cleared out, they're no longer suffering from that internal bleeding. They can absorb nutrients better. They can be healthier. And that can benefit them in many ways. So there's the straight-up health benefits. But the health and nutrition benefits open up the possibility that these kids will learn more and go to school more, too.
And who helps deliver the message in these communities to use this treatment? Is it a character that they would know? Is it culturally sensitive in some way, and that it's a message delivered in different ways in different countries? You know, a worm is a worm is a worm. Is it just a scary picture of a worm on a poster pretty much everywhere in the world?
That's a great question. In terms of the individuals who deliver it, it's typically kids' own teachers who receive training in delivering the drugs and giving the worm prevention health education messages. So in that sense, it's someone close to them. In terms of the actual messaging, it does need to be culturally sensitive. So again, in the region of Kenya where I've worked, people are very aware that they have worms. As I mentioned, just about everybody in these communities is infected with worms, and sometimes they can see the worms in their fecal matter and whatnot. So they're aware that they have them. But their notion about whether worms are good or bad is kind of mixed. You know, there's some traditional views about worms being necessary for digestion or just a natural part of life. And then there are these counter messages about worms being bad for health that, are really part of the biomedical paradigm. So there really does need to be local cultural modification of the messaging. But in most places where these programs have been rolled out, there's very high take-up rates, and you know, the vast majority of people in the community are willing to go ahead and try to eliminate these worms from their kids' lives.
Is $6 billion enough to deal significantly with the real impact on the problem as you see it?
Oh, that would be much more than would be needed. So the typical cost of deworming in some of the recent studies, in terms of the mass programs, might be something on the order of 20 cents or 30 cents per child per year, so way less than a dollar per year. So when you think about, if there were mass treatment programs everywhere these infections were found, and there's about, say, 700-900 million kids with these infections, you could really treat them for much less than $1 billion. So something like $6 billion would treat everybody many times over for these infections.
And yet $6 billion is about what we spend deworming animals in agriculture.
Yeah, you know, I've seen numbers like that, and it is staggering to me to think that for really a tiny fraction of that, probably less than 10% of that dollar amount, we could deworm every kid around the world. It is a little demoralizing. I think it speaks to just how much inequality there is in the world that we live in. But maybe by deworming more kids and expanding these programs, we can do something.
Why has this been such a debate this summer?
I think some of it has to do with views about health policy. You know, worms aren't a disease that typically kill people. It's not HIV. It's not malaria. It's not TB. I think for some in the health policy world, there's a real push to focus on those killers. And I totally understand why. It's a reasonable thing to focus on those killers. Focusing on diseases that don't kill but do affect people's lives is still important. And we shouldn't move away from doing all that we can to improve health and nutrition for these non-fatal diseases just because there are fatal diseases. Part of the debate has been health researchers really pushing back against those studies or not including those studies when they make policy recommendations. So there's a group of health researchers that came out with recommendations about mass deworming that really didn't put any stock in that growing body of research from social science. I think that's a mistake because those are some of those studies are very high quality studies. Some of them are randomized experiments themselves, even if they don't conform to the strictest medical trial. And we can learn a lot from those studies that's important for public policy.
Finally, do you have a picture in your mind of a clinical setting where you've seen this treatment work and the impact it has on young children and how you've been able to interact with them?
Certainly in the Kenyan setting where I've done work for a long time, when the deworming was going on and I was there in Kenya, I had numerous conversations with children, with teachers, with parents who gave testimonials about how kids' health improved after they were dewormed, how they were energetic, how they could run more, how they felt better. Seeing those benefits firsthand is certainly something that makes a powerful impression on somebody.
You've never gotten worms, have you, Edward?
I don't think so. You know, maybe I have, but if I have, I haven't known about it. I've been, you know, fortunate enough to, you know, to be in a place with good hygiene and good sanitation. So I feel lucky that I haven't had to go through that.
Edward Miguel is the Oxfam Professor of Environmental and Resource Economics in the Department of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Ed, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And there we go. Goals humble and ambitious, requiring cooperation over competition for the people of a small planet trying to sustain life for a civilization that will soon number 9 billion. A great story for this Labor Day. But take a breath. Enjoy this day. The traditional summer has slipped by once again. We'll all get down to business tomorrow, except for me. Todd Zwillick will be here tomorrow. I'm back on Wednesday. Until then, be well. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.